Hello everyone, my name is Ryan and you are listening to The Vegan Report. Today we are exploring the dark world of animal experimentation. And to guide us through this journey is Madeline Krasno. From 2011 to 2013, Madeline cared for over 500 monkeys at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Harlow Primate Research Lab, an experience that left her with PTSD and ignited her passion for change. She recently co-founded Justify, an organization dedicated to advancing science without human or animal suffering. Madeline's mission is to build the community she desperately needed when she left the primate lab back in 2013, and to push for a future where science and ethics go hand in hand. Thank you so much, Maddie, for having accepted my invitation, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start by congratulating you on obtaining a nonprofit status. It's wonderful. Yeah. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we are very excited. Big plans ahead for Justify.
So let me start with this. Why did you name your nonprofit Justify?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So, you know, the way that Justify came about was that me and the two co-founders, who have also both worked in animal research or animal research labs to some capacity, had come together and were really kind of acting as this supportive community for each other, talking about our experiences. And as we did that, we were finding that it was really healing to be able to talk to someone who not only like understood what it was actually like to be in the lab, but was very non-judgmental about it. And also, you know, the three of us are all big animal lovers. We're animal activists. And, you know, it can be a little scary to be talking about this kind of experience in the animal rights space. There can be a lot of judgment about how did you end up there? Like, why didn't you just immediately leave? So anyway, finding this community was really helpful for us. And it was through that then we started realizing like, this community needs to be bigger. Like there's probably more of us out there. We know there's more of us out there. And we want to create that. And so that's where like the idea for Justify came about. And then in terms of, you know, the name, we were tossing things back and forth for a while. But what we kept coming back to is, you know, how the animal research industry is able to keep going, like its history and how strong it is today, and how what really has kind of kept up the momentum is the justifications behind it. And what happens with those justifications, how those justifications affect us. So like, you know, what happens when we justify what we're doing, whether that justification is for the greater good, or whether it's, you know, in my case, like I was staying in the lab because I was worried that someone who cared less about the monkeys would be in charge of their care. And so, you know, that's how I was justifying this. And then what were the implications of my justification? I mean, the ramifications ended up being that I was diagnosed with PTSD. And so I think there's a lot of ways to like look at this and kind of dissect that word justify, because I really think it's core to the animal research industry and just how it continues, how it stays strong, stays funded.
Yes, it's an engaging word, justify. Yeah. I like it a lot. Mm-hmm. And it goes at the heart of the world of animal experimentation. You mentioned justify for the greater good. I think that for the general public, the idea of a lipstick company experimenting on rabbits or monkeys is despicable. I think mm-hmm. that we arrived at that point. But there is still this idea that if it's for a greater good, if it's, you know, to fight a disease or something like that, then we are justified to torture those animals. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah, I think it's interesting because I agree that the whole cosmetics thing is really kind of on its way out. And people have sort of accepted that and championed that, which is great. But I think there's also just some misunderstanding about how little that's actually what's even taking place at this point. People will say, like, oh, don't worry, I'm cruelty free. Like, I only buy cruelty free products. But I think there's, again, sort of this lack of understanding of how much of the research taking place has nothing to do with, cosmetics at this point, things like that. So I think that's a piece of things. And then, this whole greater good discussion. It's just not black and white. And I think that there's been, the message that's put out there, especially by the industry, is that, if would you choose this rat over, this child, or would you choose this monkey over your grandma? And that, of course, is going to immediately bring up these really strong emotions. Humans tend to care very deeply, and more so towards humans. And so I think it's understandable that people's reaction is like, grandma, like, or this child. But I also think that it's manipulation, because that's not actually how animal experimentation works. It's not like, here's this rat, and if we just do this one thing to the rat, here's the cure. There's so much more that takes place, so much more funding, so many more lives that are being used, and often not coming up actually with that cure. It's kind of like rolling the dice. It's like, I mean, in some ways, it's like winning the lottery. You keep trying, and like, if you keep entering, you might win, but like, your chances very slim. And so I think there needs to be some sort of like, the public needs to be more aware of like what this process actually looks like, how successful animal experimentation actually is when it comes to these, big, incredible finds, discoveries, whatever. Because the messaging is so compelling, of course, but it's also very misleading, and it's just not that simple.
I think there are a lot of parallels that could be drawn between this industry of animal exploitation and the factory farming industry, starting with the fact that it's hidden. And like you said, it's very obscure. If you ask people, where are they doing that kind of research? I don't think your average person could, point to a place. So what do you say about this fact that it's hidden and that there's this lack of knowledge and understanding of this industry?
Yeah, I mean, it's very deliberate. What we are fed, like, as the public versus what is actually taking place, it's meant to be palatable. It's meant to, invoke trust in, the industry, that, what they're saying is true. And if we just keep as much of it concealed as possible, then how are they going to know? So yeah, it's a deliberate move. I mean, it reminds me, this is a little bit of a tangent, but are you familiar with Fair Oaks Farms in Indiana?
No.
Okay, so this may fascinate you. This is a factory farm that is open to the public. It is sort of like marketed as Disneyland, but it's a farm, and it's a factory farm. I had learned about it and decided, and I should like premise all of this that like I or preface, sorry, premise, preface all of this by saying that, I've worked in animal protection for like about a decade, since I basically left the animal research lab that I worked in. And I was doing a lot with farm animal sanctuaries and educating about our food system and the treatment of farm animals. And so when I learned about this, as much as it sounds horrific, I wanted to go because I wanted to see, like, what is it they're doing? What does that look like? And I mean, it's very much meant to be like, well, if we show you exactly what we want you to see and hear, then we'll help you feel good about what we're doing. And so, I remember, first of all, the night before I was going to be going, I could barely eat. Like I felt so sick to my stomach that I was even going to be showing up at this facility where I knew like what was taking place, where these animals would go, their story, what would happen to them. So anyway, what was interesting about the place and what is coming to mind is like the way that they display things. So like for example, with the pig area. So they had a cow area and they had a pig area, like dairy cows, pigs. And with the pigs, there's all these like different rooms where you've got different age pigs and you look down and you can see them. You can even see like there's moms in gestation crates with the babies, or sorry, in farrowing crates with the babies, eating. And you can see actually moms in gestation crates and like, lots of babies running around in different rooms. So like, and people are looking down and like oohing and aahing because like cute little baby pigs, right? And they're seeing some of these things. And if you're not familiar with like what a gestation crate is and what that's really like, or what a farrowing crate is and what that's really like for these individuals, you're seeing this and they're kind of just hanging out and it's quiet because guess what? You see them, but it's soundproof. So you cannot hear their screams, like even if like pigs are fighting, and you can see scrapes on some of their backs from them getting in fights, but you can't hear anything. So like they've decided that the sound is not worth, experiencing, which I think is really interesting because it takes away the chaos of what is being felt by these pigs, right? And similarly, like there's a little spot where they had like taken two newborn piglets and they had them in this little like container, and it was like a group would stand around and they'd be like, let's name the babies. And it's like this dissociation, or what am I trying to say? Not dissociation, like
Separation.
compartmentalizing, of just like, oh my gosh, they're so cute, let's name them. And then they're going to, go be made into pork, bacon, whatever. And when you ask the staff questions, they have very deliberate answers. Like I had asked, for example, why do the piglets, like why don't they have tails? And I know the answer to this. I know they're cutting off the tails because, especially in crowded situations, they get really stressed and they end up biting each other's tails off. And so they just cut them off right away. But they danced around that and said it was better for them, like for their well-being or something like that, but they won't actually tell you the truth, which is that these animals are very stressed out and, the situation they've been put in is unnatural to say the least. So, I think about this, and then there's also like all of this marketing taking place. Like you see a sign and it's like half a pig face and half a human face, and it's like pigs are so intelligent, they can play video games. And it's like comparing like humans and pigs and telling you like they're so great. And then in like the next display it's like, and this is why it's important to eat pork, you know what I mean? And you're like, oh my God, your face. No, I mean, it's literally like mind-blowing. And this is just like, the pig section. There's a whole dairy section, which, same type of like, this is what you see, this is what we're gonna show you, this is what we're gonna say. And all of this is meant to sort of make you like feel like be able to ooh and awe at this and say, like, oh, cute, look at the pigs, and then go to the restaurant that's on property and eat them. So I mean, it's a little absurd. And yet I'm on a bus with my mom, and on the bus is a bunch of kids with teachers. And I heard one of the kids say, it's like Disneyland. And that I think is very similar to what, we want people to view the animal experimentation industry as. Like, we're going to give you something that feels palatable. There are these very exciting things that could potentially happen that could, save the world, save, cure this disease. But in terms of the follow through, in terms of what actually is coming out of it, it's like there isn't actually accountability. We're not looking at it by the numbers of, you know, the animals whose lives, what those lives are about day to day, what they experience in the actual experiments, where they're coming from, if they're actually taken from the wild or bred in these labs themselves. You know, we're not looking at the amount of funding that is funneled into this and, you know, comes out with what. We're not looking at the number of researchers or people who go into this field and end up leaving because, you know, they're told they can't handle it, but in reality, it's like they start to have ethical issues with what's taking place. And then we lose these compassionate scientists who could probably be doing amazing things because, you know, they're all geared, you know, they're all like funneled towards you got to do animal testing in some way. We're not looking at where this funding could actually change human lives today, like in this moment. There's so many people who still don't have access to healthcare, medication, things that actually exist right now, things that might have even come from animal research, but they still won't even ever have access to it because they don't have the funds or the means to get that because the way these systems work. And so it's like, I just think there's so much more we have to look at when it comes to this industry and why things are currently functioning the way they are. Because if this is really for the greater good, if this is really about helping humans, you know, the number of people who have just said, like, I can't afford therapy. And yet I know, like, at my alma mater, they're inducing extreme anxiety in female monkeys to study anxiety. And it's like, how about we get people who have anxiety? There's so many of us. Here I am. You know, talk to them, give them access to what actually exists, because chances are, you know, with the cost of healthcare, with the cost of health insurance, like these things are just not accessible. And so it just feels like we're doing this thing over here and putting all of these resources into it when you could take so many of those resources and actually make a huge difference. And so I just think there's a lot of things to look at here. And ultimately, messaging, I think, has a lot to do with it in terms of how they're like marketing this industry and this idea of what's going to come from it, as opposed to what we could do now with these resources.
And I'm thinking about how there's this mental health crisis in college campuses, which is this added detail that just drives you crazy. No pun intended. But let me just quickly go back to that shocking story of Disneyland slaughterhouse. I just want to know. Did those kids, well, first of all, were you allowed to take pictures?
I have pictures, and you can even like you can go to their Instagram, you can go to their website and see what it is they want to put out there. I took pictures of like some of those signs. That's why like I remember them, because it's now, I mean, honestly, this was like 6, 7 years ago or something that I had gone there. So it's been a while, and I'm sure there's more that's changed about it. I know they were talking about having a chicken facility. I don't know if that actually happened. But this, they get, they're like south of Chicago. So they get, you know, busloads of kids, like field trips and, you know, and even other like types of groups that come for tours. I mean, it is like this destination. They were building a hotel on property. Outside, there was a dog run. If you brought your dog, there was a little place where the dog could run. And, you know, because, you know, we don't eat those ones. So yeah, there, I mean, the disconnect was fascinating and infuriating, to say the least.
In Chicago, the birthplace of the modern factory farm, it's the more I'm thinking about it, the more twisted it seems, because the people who designed that place must know that people would badly react to, for instance, hearing those cries, those screams,
Sure.
That's why they built the soundproofing system. So they
Yeah,
know they are
it's
suffering.
creepy. I
Yes.
mean it, yeah.
They know they are lying to the public, and they're thinking about selling that lie
Yeah.
and protecting that lie. Now, when I became vegan a little bit more than 9 years ago, I was taught that, well, I learned that you don't go to those places. You never visit them. You don't visit a zoo or any of those facilities where you exploit animals for entertainment.
Sure.
Recently, in a podcast dedicated to veterinarians, I had Dr. Crystal Heath, and she said, no, as a vegan, you should go to those places and you should document the sufferings that you see. There should be someone witnessing the bad things happening in the zoo and in that place. So why is it important for us to visit those kinds of places? And how did you find in you the, motivation to go and visit that place?
Yeah. Well, first I want to say that Dr. Heath is incredible, and I've been working closely with her. She is her organization, Our Honor, is our fiscal sponsor as we are pursuing nonprofit status for Justify. And I've just learned so much from her and really respect everything she does and her viewpoint on things. I went from growing up, like I would visit zoos, and then to a point where I was like, I don't want to visit zoos because, then it looks like I support zoos. And now I'm sort of back at this point where I'm like, well, it depends on why you're going. Like, what is your motivation? And even if you're bringing children, like, are you talking to them about what this means and what, like, for these animals and what their experience looks like? Or are you just saying, look at that, a lion, this is so cool, moving on. Look at that, a giraffe, this is so cool, moving on. Like, are we having conversations about, what is actually happening here? Because then I think it's different, and it's important, as Dr. Heath said, to be aware of, because if no one is documenting what's going on, then we don't know when those animals are sort of left to, whatever care is happening to them. So I think, when it came to visiting Fair Oaks, I of course did not want to. I mean, I felt sick to my stomach the night before. I felt like, and I don't, I'm one of those people that doesn't like to make comparisons or is very like careful about this sort of thing, but as someone who's Jewish, I couldn't help but feel like I was visiting some sort of like concentration camp, like some this sort of like the fact that I'm going to this place where I view these animals so differently. Like, I literally just come from working, as a tour guide for a farm animal sanctuary where these animals are rescued from this industry and they're living this beautiful life, alongside, other rescued animals and community, and where they're cared for and their needs are put first. And so it felt very sickening to me to be entering this like alternate universe where, all I can think about is not just what they're going through, but what their end is. And it really just had me thinking, yeah, about that. I think I had just recently read, and I feel like I don't know how to properly pronounce his name, but Eli Wiesel or L Ellie Wiesel, Weasel, yeah.
Sounds
Whoever's
familiar,
listening to this,
yes.
don't judge me. But the book Night. I had just read that, and I had, it just was all kind of, I remember discussing this with my mom and just feeling like, and I don't know, I'm not the type of person that is like, this is just like, I do not, I personally do not agree with things like this is the Holocaust or this is like the Holocaust. But I think, like, as a Jewish person whose family, I did, there's family that perished in the Holocaust, like, there are pieces of this where I can see patterns, Patterns in how we treat animals and how like certain groups of humans are treated. And it just, yeah, like I felt it was like a betrayal. Like I felt like I was engaging in betrayal. But then at the same time, I'm like, well, if I don't see it and share what I see and what that experience was like, then there's fewer people like me who are coming at it from that perspective, as opposed to, look at this, you guys, I just went to Disneyland. It's so great. Like, look at these cute piglets that were, in this, just born sign. Like, it's that those perspectives need to come take place. And so it's not easy to sort of, I don't know, like make yourself do that. And I wouldn't say that anyone needs to make themselves do that, like you don't need to put yourself through something if you feel like it's, you're not ready for it or it's going to cause, extreme trauma. Like I think there's other ways to contribute to creating a just world. But if you are able and to, I think that that can be really important. And so that's kind of ultimately how I justified that choice.
Yes, the comparison with, the Holocaust is fascinating. Have you heard of the book, An Eternal Treblinka?
Yes, I have, and I have not read it, but I definitely have heard of it. Yes. I think it was one of those that like I know I should read, but it was like, am I ready to read this? And so far I have not been, but yeah.
This book left a deep impression on me. I definitely recommend the book for those who are listening. It's an excellent book. It's a classic of animal rights. So, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So, Maddie, were you one of those people who believed the lie before being, starting working for that lab at your college? Were you part of those people who were, not aware at all of the cruelty of the animal experimentation industry?
Yeah, I felt very unaware. And it's so interesting because even recently the social media world is fascinating because it gives people a platform. It gives people a platform even if they stay anonymous to just say some pretty awful things. And a lot of what I see are things like, how could you possibly not know? And one of the things that I think is really important is like, Instagram, I think, was created my sophomore year of college. That was like when it first started. And I joined, I ended up becoming an animal caretaker at the lab the spring of my sophomore year of college. There wasn't And I, wasn't a huge social media person. And, I didn't really read the news. So, like, I think people sort of forget that, and I still think that there's people today who go into labs and are not aware truly of how, of what the day-to-day is like, of what this is really like to see animals like this, of the trauma that can develop over time. But even so, especially for me back then, it was like, if you're not like reading books on it, it was very easy to not really know and to just, know the sound bites or whatever, which are, it's for the greater good. Like we've had all these amazing discoveries. It's so important. And in my mind, I had decided, I had always looked up to Jane Goodall. I really wanted to work in primate conservation. I just thought primates were fascinating. I saw myself doing that. And so with two primate labs on campus, I was like, well, I could get some experience and this would be like a great letter of recommendation for them like moving forward. And that was really how I viewed it. I did not, oh my God, I did not have any idea that I would come out, of that lab experiencing, being diagnosed with PTSD and experiencing, repetitive nightmares, being back in the lab, trying to take photos, but the photos won't be taken because I hate that I never took photos. So I'm like punishing myself in my dreams. I think that, again, I think activists kind of forget that they live in a bubble and that a lot of people really don't know, even if it's like animal research. So you're like, putting, I don't know, like doing an injection into an animal, like that can seem very chill. Because like animals get shots at the vet. So what's the difference? And one of the things that I really like to talk about, especially from the perspective of a caretaker, is what it's like to see these animals day to day living in barren cages with barely any stimulation, some of them living alone. I mean, it's kind of crazy making, and the way we justify this existence for them. I think that that's not talked about enough. Sometimes we're so focused on the research that like we forget that there's this whole being that has a life and what that life is like, not just in the actual research study.
I completely relate because I remember being a kid and wanting to work for a pet store. And I thought, I love animals.
Of
So this
course.
is the best job for me.
Yeah.
I will be caring for, dogs and all sorts of animals all day long. This would be
Yeah.
wonderful.
Of course.
So what was the process of getting selected to become the caretaker? How do they let you in and employ, how do they choose their employees, basically?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this was so I left back in 2013. Like, I was there 2011 to 2013, and I graduated in 2013. So it is definitely possible that things have changed, that the process, I imagine, has definitely evolved with social media. Because like there wouldn't have been anything for them to look up at the time about me. And I wasn't an animal rights activist, so it's, the point there is moot, but like I just think it's interesting nowadays that I'm sure that they're doing deep dives to make sure whoever they're allowing in doesn't have a secret agenda. But yeah, in my case, I saw the application for a student caretaker role, and that's like kind of what I was waiting for. I remember like for weeks, like I was like told that that's where like it would be, and that they would, be up on the job site for the university. And when that finally went up, I applied. I was emphasizing my background in caretaking because I had been babysitting for human children since I was 10 years old. Just babysitting, nannying on and off. I really loved kids. I was actually majoring in child development, and I had added zoology as a double major. And of course, I had also done like pet care gigs growing up. So like loved animals, was a natural caretaker. And I know that like when I got the interview, and then actually when I was hired, my boss, the director of animal care, had told me that I really reminded her of one of their caretakers who ended up training me. And that's like why I was hired. Like, I mean, the caretaker background and just who I was and how I seemed like a really hard worker and very, just sort of like dedicated to whatever I was doing, which was true. I mean, I was very passionate. I was very excited. I mean, I'm sure they could tell I wanted this job. I before the first before the interview, I paced outside on the phone with my mom for an hour. Like, and she was just like, "It's gonna be fine. It's gonna be fine." Like, I mean, I thought that if I didn't get this, like somehow my future with Jane Goodall would never happen. Like that's where I was in my brain. I don't remember. I get asked this a lot, so I'm just going to answer it. I don't remember if I signed an NDA. I don't remember what sort of documents I signed. I remember being told you're not allowed to take pictures. I mean, when I started, I had like a, I didn't even have an iPhone. I think I had like a flip phone or something like that. So again, the time that like digitally things have changed since then, which I'm sure adds a whole other layer to this work. But yeah, that's, and you know, so I was hired. And then immediately, you know, started training and started going, oh, this is not quite what I thought it would be. Meanwhile, you know, people on campus would be like, it's so cool that you play with monkeys all day. And I was like, yeah, that's not what I do, but
You never took pictures of, inside the place, but
yeah.
I'm sure they were filming everything, the experiments. And I know that there are plenty of animal rights nonprofits like Animal Partisan who sued those labs in order to get that footage and publish that footage.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's possible. Yeah, I know that that took place again with OHSU, who was mentioned, and a vole study where they were deleting footage, that they weren't supposed to be deleting. So, I don't know how much that's like happened with Madison. I do know that there was someone was undercover there after my time there. And that undercover kind of investigation came to light around the time I moved to the Bay Area. So that was like 2019. And I remember seeing the footage. And I was triggered. That was one of the times that I was triggered into sort of one of my, I'm never really sure how to describe it. I guess it's kind of a panic attack, but you know, from my PTSD, like watching it and stuff, and all of a sudden being like, oh God, oh God, oh God, like I'm here again, and having a lot of trouble trying to sort of tell myself you're safe, you're not there, you know. And because it was just, and it was interesting too. I mean, side note, but I just remember, of course, what the university was saying, which is, you know, things were taken out of context, and you know, this is not, you know, this was just one case, or this was just one monkey, or blah blah blah. And you know, for someone who has been in these labs and see, like, I don't know how any of that could be taken out of context. This is their lives, you know. Like there were times where I would walk into rooms, and even as the caretaker, you know, baby monkeys would cower, like holding each other in the corner of their cages, because they can't necessarily tell us apart. They don't know who the researcher is versus me. And it's not like I didn't have to do things that were scary, you know, like if a monkey needed a shot because, you know, diarrhea was so common. They like all had diarrhea because they're stressed, you know? And so we're like constantly treating them, and this is, you know, stressful. And it's just this cycle of what happens when you keep animals like this in such unnatural, frightening environments.
When did you start realizing that there is something incredibly wrong with this place?
I mean, I think there's like different sort of there's like flashes of different memories. And yeah, I always like to include the fact that, unfortunately, to protect myself, and I kind of learned sort of this later on that this is very natural with trauma, but I suppressed a lot of my memories. So, you know, for someone who was there for 2 years, about 10 to 12 hours a week, I don't have, there's not a lot there because of how, you know, upsetting it was. But there's different things that sort of kind of were raising alarm bells, I would say, if that's the right phrase. You know, one of which was on one of the first days. And again, this wasn't the sort of like, get me out of here, but this was an immediate kind of realization that I was uncomfortable. And what happened was, is that I was brought into, there's only one room in this whole facility where there was like groups living together. And it was like, there would be like one big breeder male, and then like some younger or some like females and maybe some younger males. And it was like this kind of smaller breeding colony. But they're basically in like a giant cage. Like it's not like what I described at OHSU, like with this outdoor thing. It was just like a larger giant cage. You know, sometimes there'd be like feces piling up on the floor because the drain is full and it's like dark. The lighting's not great. I mean, it's still, again, just this giant cage. There were like, I think there were eight cages, if I'm remembering properly, but you know, don't quote me on it. And that was the first room with primates that I was brought into, which again, I think is very deliberate. It's like, oh, look, like it's kind of like a family. And I was being taught by my boss, how to give them the treats that they're allowed to have, which are peanuts. We would roll, like, we had these giant bins on wheels, like basically garbage bins that were just full with peanuts. And you could, you know, give them a peanut. And we're garbed up. So we're in like, you know, we've got like two layers of gloves, like latex and vinyl. We've got, you know, we're in scrubs, we've got jackets, we've got a face shield, we got a mask. It's actually so, you know, when the pandemic hit and people were masking again, I had this like such a weird reaction to it, especially when I first put on the mask, because there's a certain smell. And it was very strange because it was the first time I'd really worn masks again. And it was triggering. It didn't keep me from wearing masks, but it was like this sort of like, oh God, suddenly like I feel like I'm garbing up to go into the primate lab. Anyway, side note. In this room, you know, she was showing me how to give the peanuts. And the thing is, though, is especially with primates, primates are very social animals. They have like their own kind of hierarchy within their family groups or groups. And so what I was noticing is like how, oh my God, like the peanuts, they were so excited. It was like the best thing that had happened to them, the fact that we were bringing these peanuts in, which in and of itself felt really depressing because it's like, oh, this is what you live for. You know, and then the fact that like because of this like dominance hierarchy, some of them, it was really hard to get them peanuts because the more dominant ones would come and take all of the peanuts. And then I feel bad because I'm like, oh my God, I can't get you a peanut. And how am I going to get you a peanut? And so I'm sitting there like the power, you know, the power difference of like me basically giving them peanuts and how like I get to leave this facility and they don't. The fact that like this thing that they're so excited about, I'm struggling to even make it fair in my brain to like get each one of them, you know, the treat. I mean, this was like, this would have been like the first day that I was working. And I just was like, ew, you know? Like, and so, you know, that happened and, you know, more training takes place. I mean, I guess another thing where like stuff really sort of hit was when I was caring for the first like rejected newborn. The one like the first one that I cared for on my own. So like after like I wasn't being trained. It was like I came in after hours. So because these newborns, sometimes I say things and I realize it's not like obvious to people, but basically what happens is these monkeys, this was a breeding facility. So Harlow Primate Lab, where I worked, was also a breeding facility where they would ship monkeys all over the country to other facilities. And so, you know, female monkeys would be put in with males. We'd be watching their ovulation cycles, you know, recording menses and stuff. And then they would be put in with some of these breeder males, who lived alone but would just have females coming and going, basically. And, you know, oftentimes these monkeys, like the females wouldn't necessarily know these males, and this could be really scary. It could lead to fights, it could lead to injuries. I remember hearing, I mean, yeah, these like when those fights would take place and you'd come running because you'd hear the screams and see what, you know, what was the damage. You know, in nature, these animals are they have very large social groups where they're learning from each other and helping each other raise their babies. And this is very unnatural. So, like, all of a sudden, you've got a young monkey who's never had a baby before. They have a baby, and sometimes they don't know what to do with it. And so they just will, the way that we know they've rejected the baby is if we walk in and the baby's on the floor, like they're not holding the baby. And sometimes we're able to get the baby before something happens, but sometimes we walk in and it's too late and the baby's died. And it's not, usually anything malicious from the mother. It's just that, it's the situation they're in, it's the environment they're in. And so with these rejected newborns, the idea was that we would care for them, we would syringe feed them, and then we would eventually cross foster them with a mom who typically had had a baby, but whose baby had been removed from them, which would usually happen at 6 to 12 months of age. Their babies would be taken. And so usually one of those moms at that point was so desperate to have her baby back that they would accept this baby to take care of. And so anyway, that brings us to St. Patrick's Day. Holidays were a day when the labs were very quiet, and but if there was a rejected newborn who needed, multiple feedings. So I was coming in and taking care of this baby, and especially with no one around, it just felt like I was very much in my head and looking down at these big eyes. I mean, they're so little and they're so perfect. I mean, these adorable baby rhesus monkeys, the way he wrapped his hands, or sorry, yeah, his arms around my the top part of my hand, like my fingers, and then his legs were wrapped around my wrist. And I would just use the syringe with the other hand to feed him. And I just wanted to sit there and comfort him and cuddle him and, take care of him. And, I wanted to give him a name because all of them just have name, like numbers, letters and numbers, AB42 or whatever, AX38. That was how they were referred to, in a facility where there's over 500 of them. And so I had given him the name Patrick because I'm not creative. and, I'm sitting there thinking about Patrick, and I'm thinking about the fact that, it's so nice to be able to take care of him. And, even though he was rejected, and then there's this other part of me is like, would he be better off dead? What's going to happen to him? Like, what happens after this? Like, I take care of him. He's cross-fostered, then he's stolen from this mother who, shows him this love. And then, I don't know what's gonna, I don't know what his future holds. And that was a turning point. And that would have been very early on in my hiring as well. And years later, after I had left the lab, he kind of, and when I sort of was starting to come to this conclusion of I need to take care of this part of me and figure out how I'm gonna deal with this. It felt really meaningful to get a tattoo that was for Patrick. And so a lot of people have probably seen that, on my bicep, I have a tattoo that says for Patrick, and it's kind of this remembrance, this sort of reminder that everything I'm doing is for him and for the rest of these individuals that, oftentimes go unnamed and unknown and un, you know, just not remembered. I like the way that Joanne MacArthur had put it, like the ghosts in our machine.
That's beautiful. And you did write about your experience in an op-ed. I will leave a link in the description for people. I highly recommend people read the op-ed. In that article, you also talk about another monkey, and now I'm forgetting his name,
Norm.
Norm, yes, and how he was particularly affectionate towards humans. Can you tell his story?
So Norm was such a bizarre case, because, rhesus monkeys as a species, they're not like nice monkeys. I think they're great and they're entitled to be who they are. That's just like who they are. But they're not like, it's very unusual for them to not just be sort of like chill, but actually seek affection from humans. Monkeys in general see eye contact as a threat, and Norm didn't, or at least like he did, he could tell with us like whether or not that eye contact was a problem, whereas most would just see it and be like, you are threatening me. And so Norm, I met again like early on in my training because some of the other caretakers were showing me around, and Norm was one of the only monkeys who, at least on the caretaker side of things, had a name that was given to him by like care staff. So this was not like me giving Patrick a name. This was like he was known as Norm. People like gave him a name because he had sort of made himself known. I mean, it was so hard to individualize these animals. They didn't want us to. It wasn't really preferred because the more you individualize someone, the more you care about them, the more that, you know, what you're doing seems to make you conflicted about it. So with Norm, okay, so basically my caretaker, the other caretaker was showing me with Norm that he would come and press his arm against the like mesh caging, and then my coworker was using his fingers to groom Norm again, like with gloved hands, as if like what monkeys do, they groom each other. I mean, it's a very natural behavior. It's a soothing thing that they do, and he would seek that out from the caretakers. And then my coworker put his arm, which was like jacketed against the mesh, and Norm would do the same thing back, using his fingers to groom, or you know, something of that sort, back to like back for the coworker. And so I quickly started doing that. And of course, they were like, you know, don't tell anyone you're doing this. You're not supposed to do this. Like, we're not, you know, especially because these animals are very dangerous. I mean, I, you know, almost had a fingertip taken off. So, like, this is not something where it's like, yes, try to have this relationship with everybody. But Norm was Norm. And so he was just kind of like one of those where, like, brought some sort of joy in moments, like to just have that kind of relationship, and also sadness because it's like, why are you, yeah, like you're so trusting of us, and yet like we're the reason you're here and that this is your life. So again, there were so many conflicting feelings, but what ended up happening is that Norm was gone one day, and I was like, finally asked, where's Norm? And I was told that he was put into a research study specifically on alcohol, where he was given unlimited access to alcohol. And so what this meant was there were a few rooms where researchers had monkeys that we did not take care of. They were strictly under like research care. So he was now one of those. And so I never saw him again. I don't know what happened to him. I mean, I can imagine that if you're given unlimited access to alcohol and this is your life, it's hard for me to believe that he didn't like drink himself to death. I assume that if he didn't, they probably killed him to, I don't know, look at what the alcohol did to his body, to his brain. And I just, it's like so. This story, it just always gets me because I just think about like how like the betrayal that he must have felt. And you know, like I'm not trying to like say what an animal feels or like get to, I don't know, make these assumptions, but I don't know, like we, you know, like I know what my dog feels when I'm leaving her, like, you know, when I'm leaving to go do something where she's not coming along. And then it's like, it's hard for me to not just feel heartbroken for him, and also to wonder with the other staff how they coped with that, you know, knowing that we all sort of had this relationship with him that was pretty unique. And Do you feel bad for betraying him in that way? 'Cause like I do. I think about him all the time. And yeah, it just like I wonder if he was doing that and he was still trying to like get people to groom him while he was like being allowed to like drink himself to death. It's just And then, and there's like this whole like emotional factor, and then there's just this logic factor of like, what? Like, we can't, what do you need to know about this animal? Why does he need to be drinking this alcohol? Why are you justifying this? What can we do to help people who have, who are experiencing alcoholism that like doesn't require us to justify, the use of this animal, the use of these animals, because I'm sure that like in any kind of in like any other sort of issue, it's like there's a bunch of resources that people need access to that they don't have access to, that financially, things could change for them. And yet the way we're using resources is to do this to Norm, to do this to individuals like Norm. It's just like it's mind blowing. And again, it's, how do we justify this?
So, Maddie, after hearing all of those, gruesome details about what happened in that lab and just the violence of that place, the question that comes to mind naturally is, why did you stay?
So yeah, I think I kind of briefly touched on this, but I would say there were like two main factors. One being that I genuinely cared for these animals. And, I'm sure some of that was guilt. Some of that is just the animal lover in me. I wanted to take care of them. I wanted to do whatever I could to make their lives a little better, or maybe it's more better to say less bad. So there was that. I also felt like I had made a commitment. And I really, especially at that point in my life, had issues with like disappointing people. So I felt like I made that commitment. I felt like I needed that experience still to get from point A to point B. I don't know. In my brain, it just was like I'm just like, oh my God, if I don't get a good letter of recommendation, what happens to me? As if like my life would have been over. But like in your early 20s, like I this was my first job that wasn't babysitting, which like babysitting is a big deal. I think it's not like people sometimes don't see it as the responsibility it really is, but it's still different than like where you're like hired for a facility, you're signing documents, it just this was my first like felt like grown up job, and it felt like everything depended on it. And I realize now that's very silly, but I also can see that at that time in my life, when I was a young, impressionable person who felt like authority is authority because they deserve to be authority, not necessarily because, well, they actually deserve to be authority or know everything or, whatever that is. So yeah, it was the combination that kind of kept me there. I felt like if I left, someone else just takes my place. And what if they don't care as much? And I've talked to other lab workers, and that especially like people who have worked in the care side of things as opposed to research. And that seems to be a pretty common thing. A lot of people, if they're going into animal care, they're doing it because on some level they really care about animals. They're not there because they want to harm animals. This is their chance, like you said, with the pet store. This is their chance to be around animals. And yeah, I think we just end up sort of trying to figure out how to cope with that. Some of that is dissociating, shutting down, like I really felt like in college that I lived two different lives. I mean, there's so much I remember about the rest of my life in college. And then it was like when I was in the lab, it was like a different world.
But you were also manipulated. I mean, again, you were very young. How old were you?
So I would have been, sure, like 20, wait, I graduated 23, 21, 22, 21, 22.
That's young. That's very young.
Yeah, like 20, 21, 22. Yeah. No, I
Yes.
mean, it's really young, especially like now being in, being almost 34. I'm like, when I talk to college students, I'm like, that's so young. And this is your first experience, usually, for the most part, like away from, your parents, away from your guardians, like on your own, being impacted very intensely by whoever you're surrounded with, whoever that community is. Yeah, it's no real surprise to me, like now that I kind of am more understanding community and dynamics and just like society and how systems function, that like it's also very intelligent of them to get people in at such a young age.
A young age, and then they must have picked up on, your kind of personality, that you're a people pleaser.
Obedient
Yes.
and likes to follow rules and is very like cares a lot about how others view you, and so you want to obey, you want to succeed at whatever they want you to do.
And they must have had prior experience. Maybe stretching out decades of experience with other workers, and they must have learned, how to keep those workers in the lab to, not make them to m not make them realize what kind of place it is and to keep them longer.
I mean, it's, I think you, a lot of people, you either learn to like compartmentalize or you have to get out. And so, the longer you're there, the longer you're kind of figuring out how to just separate these things, and it the easier it's going to get because you're kind of shutting down, like you're mentally shutting down. I mean, I would even during my 2 years there, I remember like on the weekends when it was like it would be two of us student caretakers in charge of all 500 plus monkeys, like the feeding, the health checks, medications, and then hosing down all of the enclosures. The hosing down part, like I always had headphones in. This was when Rolling in the Deep, Adele's out that album from Adele had come out. I listened to that album on repeat. It's like now when I listen to that album, I almost, or like any of those songs, it's actually kind of triggering to me because I listen to it so nonstop when I would be cleaning. And it was, but it allowed me, like, it's like I'm just like hosing down. I'm able to just like not even pay attention to the fact that these individuals are just sitting here day after day, like, what do they have to do? Literally nothing. So, like, we learned to do things to disconnect, to sort of make it easier to survive.
Let's talk about the researchers. Did you consider them your colleagues or like your superiors?
It was, in my experience at this lab, it was very separate. Like he rarely came in contact with anyone who was doing research, and there was very much this kind of us and them mentality, that like I just like felt existed, where it was almost like we were often feeling like we were in the way of the researchers, even though our job was to take care of the monkeys and keep them, as healthy as possible or whatever for the researchers. So it was a little strange. And again, the more that I've talked to some other individuals who have been in labs and have been in different positions, I've heard similar things, whether it's from the researcher side of thing or caretaker, where it's like these two kind of groups are sort of separated from each other. There's not a lot of interaction, which I think is really fascinating, and also probably very deliberate. You know, yeah, I mean, I rarely interacted with any of them. And even if I was around them, it was more like I'm there in the peripheral and they're doing their thing. So.
And how did you perceive them? You know, did you think, are they feeling the same way I do?
Honestly, I mean, it was interesting because like the students I wondered about, I think the like, you know, the more like senior people, like I guess grown adults, whatever. You know, I was a little intimidated by and just sort of like, I don't know, felt like I had to like keep quiet and just set my head down and like do what you're supposed to do. Like I was nervous. The one interaction that I remember very clearly, where I was around what I assumed to be a researcher and their like assistant. Again, I don't know who these two individuals were. Could not pick them out of a lineup. but I was in like a kitchen type area preparing medications for the weekend, because there were some we could prepare ahead of time. And so I actually even I think I had headphones in. Like I was sitting there, like had my back turned doing that. And they had come in, they were carrying a mother monkey. There was a carrying cage. So it's like this metal container with these tiny little holes in it. And that is how we would transport the monkeys around the lab. And they had the carrying cage. Usually, like it sits vertically on the ground, if or sorry, horizontally on the ground. So, like, you know, it opens and it's closer to the ground. But they had it tilted so it was vertical, so that like the opening was facing upwards. And they had reached in and taken the newborn from the mother who was in there, and you know, closed it because they were, going to be tattooing the newborn's ear, because that's like how you, yeah, kept track of who they were. They were tattooed, and the mother was screaming, in the cage. And I mean, you and I would say, of course, like, you know, my baby was just ripped from me. This is what are you doing with my baby? Where are you going with them? And especially like the baby's crying, you can hear your baby crying. And I, you know, like it was obviously very upsetting, but I'm just kind of like, you know, keep doing what I'm doing. And then I turn around and I see one of them kind of nudge the crate with their foot and say, "Oh, calm down." And I just remember in that instant, I think I was like taking deep breaths because like I wanted to turn around and just start. And I knew that if I did that, all of a sudden I am labeled an animal activist. And it, even though like it's like, oh my God, it should be so obvious why they're freaking out. And like, can you have a little compassion for what these animals are experiencing right now? Like, they don't know that they're going to be reunited in a second. And also their whole history of being here and what that's been like. Like, can we take their perspective for like a half a second? So that was really frustrating. And that's, you know, one of my only experiences. And, you know, I say that and I am very upset by it. And also, I am the person who is fiercely, I don't know, advocating for people to stop demonizing people in labs because on some level, there is like, this is not just like, oh, it's a bunch of bad people doing bad things. There is a system, a very powerful system in place. I'm not saying that there's no agency. There is agency, but it's just not as black and white as people want it to be. And it's not to say that there aren't also some researchers who are doing just horrific things. And like, I completely understand the anger that comes especially from activists who are like, how could you do this? You know, like I get that. But my thing is like, I see what has happened from being able to connect with individuals and see that there's actually a large number of us who are not, you know, we're not just like cruel and hate these animals. Like, and there's people who are starting to think differently, even when they're in the lab and even when they seem like they aren't, but they're feeling pressure from others to act a certain way or to say certain things. And so like the reason that I'm going into this is because I don't want to say like these are bad people or, you know, I have this hatred towards them. I was so angry with what took place. And also, like, I have no idea what those two are doing any like today. You know, I don't know what like one of those individuals could have decided or be in the process of deciding that, like, wow, I don't know what I was doing. Because I did things I wasn't proud of in the lab. I mean, truthfully, and things that like where I even felt like this feels like I'm a monster. But I'm never going to call someone a monster. Like those of us who are coming out of this, who have had this experience and are like working through it, we know. Like we feel the guilt. We feel those feelings of being a monster. And like someone else telling you that doesn't make you want to change. So I don't know. My whole point here is just that like my experience, you know, that experience wasn't great, but it's not like it made me define who everybody is in a lab, let alone like all researchers or something. Like, I think there's like power dynamics at play and in this industry, and it really encourages people to shut down their compassion.
I mean, going back to the vegan reality, in a world where people are eating corpses, what do you expect? I mean, sure, you are an active participant in the suffering of that animal in the context of lab research. At the same time, I'm thinking it would be amazing a world like some of the best guests I had on the podcast were people who worked in the animal industry. And hearing their stories of seeing the light and seeking like a form of redemption and becoming those incredible animal rights activists just gave me so much energy, so much hope, so much inspiration. And I feel like the real victory is not to lash out on those researchers, to demonize them. The real victory is to make them your allies, is to make them see the light and just gain them as fellow vegans and fellow animal rights activists. And that's the most beautiful thing we could be doing. So yeah, it's a mix of, comments and thoughts.
You know, I hear over and over again, I just got a message from someone who had reached out a couple years ago again, who was congratulating me on launching Justify as a nonprofit and saying, you know, I'm still working through some stuff emotionally, but I would love to help if, you know, I can do anything. And so it's really rewarding to see that this work is resonating with people and making them feel like there's a community for them that is safe. You know, there's that just is sort of like what keeps me going, and what reminds me that what I'm doing matters. You know, I've recently had a PhD student who contacted me, had actually found me through my Washington Post feature, which is a whole nother kind of side of things, but having to do with a lawsuit related to free speech related to my work in the animal labs. And anyway, they had contacted me because they wanted to talk about what it had been like, what it was like doing working on their PhD and working with animals in labs. And I don't want to give away too much information because it's I'm keeping conf like some individuals that want to share their stories and some are not ready to, and some may never want to, and that is completely fine. But I think this individual, is an example of someone who, is had this experience, started to question things, started doing some Google searches to look into like what was going on, somehow found me. We had an hour and a half conversation and is now continuing to chat with more members of this community. To get ideas on where to go from here, and members of this community who, are not like necessarily sort of part of Justify, but are people who whose work is adjacent. So like someone like Dr. Aisha Akhtar, the co-founder of Center for Contemporary Sciences, big, background in science. And it was just like connecting them was great because it's like, here's someone who has all of these ideas of what you can still do in science, but not be doing this, similarly, I don't know if you're familiar with Richard J. Miller. I wanted to grab the book, but it's far away from me. The Rise and Fall of Animal Experimentation. He recently, I don't know, just like I recently learned about him. I think I found him through X, now or previously Twitter. He worked in animal research for like 4 decades, over 4 decades, and wrote this book that just came out last year. Fascinating read, highly recommend. And really kind of goes into like the history and kind of bringing up these questions of, is this what we should be doing now? Like, is this really where our focus should be if we're trying to progress science and help humans? And so being able to connect individuals within this community that they didn't even know existed is amazing. And I'm realizing is part of this work with Justify. It's not just about like, your feelings are valid, and like I've had these experiences too, and this is really hard, but it's also about like, how can we empower you to not feel like you've just like lost this community, lost this world that you thought you would be a part of or you thought you were doing and was, supposed to work out and didn't, because that can be really defeating. When it's everything you've known, like that's what you thought you were going to be doing, and you really had no idea what it would be like.
Because you chose not to demonize them and to provide them with a safe space, you've gained some powerful allies that know intimately this industry and can then help you dismantle it, end this suffering, which is, from a strategic perspective in terms of activism. It's wonderful. That's what we want.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's true. And I say that, and I agree. It's extremely strategic, but I also like I it's important for me to make it clear that it's not about being strategic for, I mean, I think it's important, obviously. Like I care about these animals. I don't want this to be happening to them. I also consider myself a social justice activist, a human rights activist. I am sick of how this industry, uses all these resources that could actually be helping people right now. Like the NIH needs to figure out how to use funding in a way that is better helping people today, right now, because that is possible. I know it is. And so my point here is just that, like, yes, it is strategic, but also like I genuinely care about these individuals. I am making some like fabulous connections and friendships, and just like growing my world and learning at the same time. And I'm not, I'm not doing this to try to create a bunch of people who think exactly like me. You know, a lot of the people I talk to are not animal activists. They're not vegan. You know, I mean, we can say everyone's pre-vegan or whatever, but I don't think that's, you know, like, it's not that I don't think it would be great. The less animals being harmed, the better, sure. But I'm also like, the more just of a world we can create, the better. And that just, there's different ways to approach that. And I, you know, when we write people off because they're not exactly where we are, it's just, it's a loss. It's a loss in general. It's a loss for animals, but it's a loss for all of us because we can learn from each other and really kind of make change together. And I never want, like with Justify, one thing that I keep saying, and you know, I will say to donors, I will say to anyone that like the last thing I'm gonna do is try to force anyone to talk. I don't want any individuals from labs to ever feel like my intention with them is to like give them a mic. If and when they are ready, that is great. And I definitely foresee it happening. Like it's I know that that will happen with some individuals, and I think that's wonderful and important. But I don't want people to think like my end goal is forcing you to talk about this or to say certain things, because I want people to be honest. I want them to, I think all of our experiences together collectively can really invoke change. And it doesn't need to be something where it's like curated that we all have the same exact opinion. This industry is very secretive, and the more variety of voices that we've got coming together and just feeling supported by each other, I think, you know, a lot of people go into animal research, even if it's not like the animal care side of things. I love animals. They're going into it because usually they want to help animals. I mean, or sorry, animals, humans, like, you know, progress medicine, things like that, because they do care. I know that there's like, you know, this whole system at play, especially with academia, with like PhD work and this idea that like you have to come up with a question and then you got to answer that question. And usually they want you to do animal testing. So it's also very like interwoven into systems. But I think that some of these individuals are also seeing that too. Like they want to see like, how can we change that? How can we stop having everything lead back to animal testing? You know, and I think that a lot of us, even people who are pro animal research, there is a level of the studies that take place that we could probably all agree on should just be done, should never take place again. There are certain things where it's like we can agree that this is unnecessary. So I think that there's points of meeting that we can come together. And yeah, I don't know. I've really come to believe in this work, and I'm feeling a lot of support, which is great. Honestly, some of the biggest criticisms so far, I'm sure there will be some from the industry, but some of the biggest criticism is from animal rights activists, which has always kind of been the case for me, because some people just can't figure out how to, I don't know, empathize, understand how I ended up in a lab despite everything I'm doing now. But I think a good chunk of the community is really supportive and realizes that we have to get outside of our own bubble, you know? Like it's just we have to embrace like our differences. We have to go back to kindergarten and, you know, figure out that like there wasn't, you know, I don't know, vegans shouldn't be put on a pedestal just because they're vegan. Animal rights activists shouldn't be put on a pedestal just because they're an animal rights activist. That doesn't mean that they're free of any sort of like, I don't know, imperfections. And I think that goes with anyone. So people have a lot to offer, and they deserve to heal too.
100% agree. I mean, it's so unfair to judge someone for the worst thing they have done in their life.
Yeah.
Like, we're bigger than that, and we have potential to do lots of good things. Let's not imprison people in their past. And also, it's always surprising to see, for me at least, to see vegans being judgmental.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think For me, it's wrong to eat animals and animal products. It's, again, going back to that image of a corpse. But I had to learn to accept, you know, people who disagree with me.
Yeah.
And to live with them and to love them and to still respect them and to still believe in what I believe and to still push that agenda of animal rights. And I found myself, you know, doing that. I found myself becoming, I guess, a bigger person, like in the sense of, you know, developing my compassion and my empathy and having this greater view of things. And I'm surprised that other vegans are not forced into that position of doing that kind of work, because I feel like I, you know, if I did not have that perspective, I would have, you know, just become mad and mad at
the
world.
That's where a lot of people are.
I mean,
you know, like I'm mad too. Like I, you know, but I think it's what do we do with that anger? How are we using it? Who are we taking it out on? You know, like, is it, does demonizing animal lab workers liberate animals? No, it doesn't. it just doesn't. And, you know, can bringing people together on common sort of core beliefs, like, I don't know, compassion and even in some ways like greater good, but looking at it differently, like, you know, like not this whole using animals for the greater good, but how can we, like, what do we think needs to actually happen for the greater good? Yeah. I think there's more alignment there. And it's just important to sort of get outside the vegan bubble.
It's simple. You'll feel happier and you'll be more impactful. I mean, that's a great deal. I mean, take it.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the anger is hard. And it's not good for us either. I mean, again, it's normal. It's, you know, it shouldn't be like, oh my God, this is so wild that you're angry. Like, of course. But yeah, if it's all that like is sort of running you, it's not good. I gave myself high blood pressure at one point. And oh my gosh, don't get me started on the number of vegans who are like, eating vegan lowers your blood pressure. Well, guess what? As a vegan, I gave myself high blood pressure. You know, that's where like the anger and the trauma, like when I really had it not under control, you know, I was being told, you got to get this under control or you need to go on medication. I was like 29, you know, like, I mean, it's so, being vegan isn't a fix-all. It's not this like, you know, it's great. It's, you know, but it's just one thing and there's so much more.
Exactly. I realized I had that phase and I realized I don't have the luxury of being angry. I really don't. Cost too much in healthcare, and I only have one life. You know, that's how poor I am. Just one. So, Maddie, did I forget to mention something? Did we forget something?
Did you forget to talk about anything? Is that what you said?
No, yes, to ask you about anything important.
I mean, not really. Like, I know we didn't talk about my lawsuits, but we definitely don't need to. We could even talk about them a different time. I think it's kind of a whole other deep dive, but yeah, if there's any listeners curious, they can look more into my social media and find information, reach out and ask. Check out the Washington Post features.
100%. Yes, I was also thinking that deserves its own episode.
Yeah.
And yes, you're welcome to come back on the show anytime, Maddie. It was really a pleasure. Really, thank you. Thank you so much for the work you're doing and for having accepted my invitation.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. And I really appreciated this like very casual conversation style. Like it just, yeah, I appreciated this discussion and I'm glad that I was invited too. Thank you so much.
Thank you everyone for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.